Okay, so I'll get started. Good morning, everybody. It's nice to be in Melbourne. Actually, I've never been to Australia and definitely haven't been to Melbourne. My memories of Melbourne as growing up weren't particularly pleasant. India would regularly lose to Australia in Melbourne, and so looks like it's a nice city still. I haven't been following cricket much, but I'm looking forward to my visit. I'm going to talk to you a little about some work in automated planning, mostly about how planners have been able to, a plan synthesis has been scaled up quite dramatically in the past several years. So I'll sort of try to make it more of an accessible thing. At least in the beginning, I'll give some background on plan synthesis, automated plan synthesis, and then get into some of the main ideas as to why we are able to actually search for plans much faster these days. So let me start with some sort of a simple background on what is planning. So again, this is like the intro to AI lecture level idea that any intelligent agent ultimately has to decide, you know, the answer to the $1 million or multi-million dollar question, what action to do next. And so in some sense, everything in AI is about what action to do next. And so the way you actually decide what actions to do next, if you want to deliberate before doing the action, is essentially that process is planning. Thank you. Okay, great. So the idea would be if the agent has a bunch of goals and then it has some effectors which it can use to do actions in the environment, and then it has some way of getting percepts from the environment as to the current state of the environment, then you know the question is based what action should I do to get to my goal? Okay. And of course, as obviously probably most of you know, the difficulty of this problem depends a lot upon a bunch of features of the agent as well as the environment. In particular, for example, whether the goals that the agent has, are they simple goals which either must be satisfied or, you know, one or zero satisfaction, or are they, would you allow partial satisfaction? So for example, I'd like to get $10 million, but if you give me 1,000, I'm not really going to say no. And then actions, are they deterministic versus stochastic? When the agent does an action, can it completely predict what the environment state would be versus is it stochastic? Are the actions instantaneous or do they take time to complete? Is the environment static or are there other agents? Is it fully observable or partially observable? And to some extent, the observability is also a function of the kind of sensors that the agent has. Does it have a cheapo sensors which basically can't really observe much versus perfect versus imperfect perception? Okay, given all these things, of course, then I guess these colors look unfortunately kind of various shades of yellow, but the blackish yellow is the good one and the bright yellow is the bad one as far as the synthesis problem is concerned. So if you have partial satisfaction, stochastic, durative actions, partially observable, dynamic, imperfect, you know, then that's our lives and it's pretty hard. And if you on the other hand have the blackish yellow stuff, that's pretty darn good. It turns out that it's better than having, as somebody was saying yesterday at the dinner, it's better than having a poke in the eye. It's better than the other case, which is, and it turns out we'll see that even that simplest case is actually quite hard. Now, in terms of the problem of deciding what actions to do next, given goals, the simplest case for solving that problem, as I said, is environment is static, deterministic, observable, instantaneous, and propositional. And so this is the simplest case, and if you say simplest planning, people are not going to be impressed, so we call it classical planning. It has a nice aura to it. Think of that as the simplest case of planning that you can look at. It turns out that in this case, planning is piece, space, hard. So, you know, as they say, if it's not at least NP-complete, it should be done in databases, not in AI. So, So we definitely have the simplest problem is P-space hard, and then we start getting warmed up. And so there is a lot of work that's been done in classical planning itself. And you can start slowly, starting from here, you can start relaxing all the assumptions you have about the world. If you, for example, say, I don't have instantaneous actions, I have durative actions, you start doing temporal planning. If you allow numerical quantities, I'm sorry for the colors, they look quite good on my laptop, but obviously not. Here, if you have propositional, if you have continuous quantities, you start supporting numerical domains and planning with numerical quantities. You can, if you have other agents, then you have to deal with replanning or, in fact, take other agents into account in doing, making up your plans. Partially observable, you start having to have conditional plans. Depending upon the observation, you wind up doing something different. Stochastic versus deterministic, again, normally this is formalized as MDP problems, but obviously, again, it's harder. And then you can start doing, you know, so I relax assumptions one by one, I can relax them two by two, and, you know, keep yourself busy for a while. So, and as you start relaxing stochastic and partially observable, that's your partially observable Markov decision processes, and clearly they're much harder to find plans for. And then if you do stochastic and durative, you wind up having semi-Markov decision processes, which are also pretty bad. And so there are classes and classes of planning problems. This is, of course, the simplest, and then on top of those are all those things. And you're trying to find, in all these cases, given a set of goals, you're trying to find what is the sequence of actions, what's the course of actions that you want to do, okay? So to some extent, one might say, I would like to know how to do this so that hopefully I'll know how to do those. This start later, yeah, that's a good idea. This start later is the right one, okay. Let's see how much is later. So what I'm going to do essentially for the rest of the talk is sort of give you an idea, a little bit more idea of how classical planning problems are, how planning problems are modeled, and then I'll also talk about you know, where the state of the art was in plan synthesis not less than 8-9 years back, which was really sad, and then I'll talk about a lot of great things that happened ever since then, and then how that advances have been used. In fact, there's a very specific theme which I'll get to called reachability analysis using planning graphs, and that has at least spawned a good cottage industry for various people, definitely for my group. Of using that sort of an analysis to solve not just the classical planning problems, but also other types of planning problems faster, okay? So the idea for looking at this to some extent is if you don't even know how to do this, you know, why are you bothering trying to do the harder one? Anyway, so going back to the planning problems, the simple planning problems, you know, you need to essentially model these by modeling the actions and the goals and the initial state descriptions. So one idea, of course, the simplest first principles idea would be to say, think of all the states as, you know, basically atomic entities, and then all actions essentially are state-to-state transformers. And so basically each action really is a matrix of this form, and if whether or not it's a deterministic versus non-deterministic action depends on whether there is a single one or multiple ones in each of the rows, and whether or not it's a stochastic or a deterministic action depends on whether you know, the entries are ones and zeros or, you know, probabilities of, you know, so for example, this one essentially says, if I were to do this action in state C, and then apparently I'll only go to state C here, whereas if I do it in state D, I'll go to state C. That's what this action says. Now, this is the simplest way of thinking about actions, and this representation, of course, holds for either classical or stochastic actions, deterministic or stochastic actions. However, mostly in planning, we tend to use factored representations. So the point about that description is all actions are about the same size. The specification of each action is a matrix of size S by S, where S is the number of states of the world. Okay. Since most reasonable worlds tend to have way too many states, you'd like to hope to see if the actions have localized effects, is there a more compact way of representing actions? Again, some of this stuff I understand is like intro to AI level, so, you know, I'm just making sure that, since this is probably more general audience, I'm just making sure that I'll repeat some of this. So anyway, so we tend to use state variable or factored models where each world state is made up of a bunch of state variables and their values, and actions are represented in terms of what state variable values they require in the beginning and what state variable values would they impose after they are done. Okay, so a simple example for this, you know, in the blocks world, where, you know, for those of you who don't know what blocks world is, it's a bunch of blocks on the table and you want to stack them in different configurations. So you have, let's say you have four different actions here, picking up a block, putting down the block, stacking block on top of block, unstacking a block from another block. And you'll notice that the state variables are of the form on table XY, on XY, clear X, hand empty, holding X. For each X, which is a constant in the domain, you have one state variable there. And so you have a simple domain for blocks world here for four actions. And here's a very simple problem. A is on table, B is on table, A is clear, B is clear, hand is empty. And my goal is to have B not clear, hand B empty. Okay, sanity check. Do we know that there's a plan for this? If not, we should actually start playing with the blocks. I hope people see that there is a plan for this. The goals don't tell you what the plan is right away, but it's obvious that if A and B are the only things on the table, the only way you can make sure that B is not clear is to put A on top of B and hand becomes empty. Okay, so that's a simple plan, you know. So we want to be able to solve, let's see, if you want to solve this, what do you do? Before I go there are standards right now in the planning community for writing these sorts of actions. Okay, so for example, there's this thing called PDDL, standard, wherein I would write the pickup action this way. It has a bunch of preconditions and a bunch of effects. And then similarly, the problem, this is a different problem than the one I showed. This is called Sussman anomaly. And basically, it allows you to specify the initial state and goal state. Now, this is the simplest kind of, this is the kind of planning problem that I'm going to be talking about for which you're going to generate sequence of actions. Now, PDDL itself has been extended in many different ways. The standard actually, surprisingly enough, wasn't arrived at until 98. You would think, why did we wait that long? But then remember that Lisp did not have a standard for the longest time. I know many of you probably don't even know Lisp. But you know, many of these things take some time. And so they had a standard for simplest PDDL in 98. And 2002, they added for time and durative actions. And then we now have a standard for stochastic outcomes. And this year, they're going to have a standard for soft constraints and preferences. A background bit of information is how do you make sure that the standard is actually used? In our community, in the automated planning community, there is a planning competition. And if you want to take part in the planning competition, you need to be able to eat PDDL. Okay? And many people, ever since people are, I mean, ever since the advent of, you know, going back to C++ style programming for everything, people find oftentimes that writing the parser for PDDL is harder than writing the planner for the domains, you know. But anyway, so that's one good way of making sure that everybody is using the standard. Okay, so PDDL is the standard. Okay, so here is very quick three-slide overview of three different planning methods that you could use at the lowest level in terms of search. To generate a solution. Remember, the problem that I'm looking for is something where A and B are on table, A and B are clear and hand is empty, and I want to get to a state where B is not clear and hand is empty. That's right. Okay. So one very simple idea is to start with the initial state. Remember that states are really complete assignments of values for state variables, and apply each of these actions. Remember, pickup A requires that certain variables have certain values, and if they do have it, then in the new state, it will ensure that certain other variables have specific values. And anything it doesn't touch with its effects, they just get copied over, okay? So for each action, you would consider generating a state, and then when you come to this state, you can check whether this state already satisfies the goal. If not, then you extend this state and further. Okay, that's the simplest idea, okay? So this is almost simple search in the forward direction. Up to that point, actually, you don't have any much of a difference between simple state-based search and planning. One difference that you'll notice here is actually that you could have done this search in the backward direction. Okay, if I give you the same actions, I could have started applying them, starting from the goal state and generating. So for example, if put down A were to be the very final action of a plan, what must have been true before put down A such that my goals would be true after put down here. Now, very simply, in this example, I know that if you do put A on table, hand would be empty, because whatever you are holding, you put it down, so hand would be empty. And I need hand empty. This guy is giving hand empty, so I don't need that to be true here, so I won't copy it anymore. Okay. The other goal, not clear B, still needs to be copied. And then, of course, since this is the last action, it better be the case that its effects, its preconditions are holding in the previous state. To be able to put down A, you better be holding A. So if this is to be the very last action, this better be the state that you want to work on. So to work on these goals, you now sub-goal on working on these goals and continue. So this is called a regression search. The other one is called the progression search. You can have all sorts of interesting discussions as to which is better. You know, one is bigger branching, one is smaller branching. I won't even get into those holy wars right now. Let me continue and say, there's yet another way of doing planning. Just to give you the fact that the process of searching for plans doesn't have to be, I mean, basically the process of searching for plans can be quite flexible. You know, in case one, here's an interesting one to note. In case one, the search states correspond to world states. Each search state corresponds to a complete world state. In search two, search state corresponds to a set of world states, because these are partial descriptions of states. So any state where these two have these values is good enough. So I don't care about the rest of the values. So each set corresponds to actually sets of world states. In search three, you'll notice that, well, look, if what I'm looking for is a plan, why am I even bothering with states? I just look for plans directly. Okay, so I would start by thinking that, well, my original plan is a null plan. I have nothing yet. Okay, here is my beginning of the plan, here is my end of the plan. Something has to come in between so that my goals would be satisfied. And then the actions, the kind of operations I would do is, for example, if in this case I have G1 and G2 need to be true at the final goal. Unfortunately, the example here is a different one than the previous one. I have to send a mail to Bill Gates. But anyway, so G1 and G2, so to have G1 true here, somebody has to support G1. So I would put, one of my operation would be get a step, put G, you know, that can give G1, put it into the plan, and say that all I need is that step comes before wherever G1 is needed. So in this case, these orderings are really, so these are steps in the plan with orderings which are really precedence relations. And you can think of these precedence relations as rubber band relations, in the sense that all we care is S3 comes before N, S infinity, which is the end of the plan. But other people can come in between too. We don't stop that from happening. Okay? And similarly, S1 is giving P to S3, and so S1 has to come before S3, but other things can possibly come in between. So you don't actually decide on the ordering up front. All you do make sure, of course, is here in this case, somebody else has been put into the plan to support G2, and this guy is deleting P, and this guy is giving P to S3. So part of the search process, you make sure that such unsafe links are also removed. Okay. So now the search operations are quite different from just going from state to state to state. Here you are adding steps, you know, you are adding steps here, or you are removing unsafe links. Okay. And when there is an unsafe link such as this, the way you can deal with it is either get S2, basically get S2 out of this region, either it can come before or after. Okay. That's another way of doing search. So you could argue as to which is the best way of doing search. There are three algorithms. There are 20 algorithms at least for doing just this simple classical planning problem. I'm not going to go into all the different search algorithms. The real question is do any of these actually work well? Okay, and you could have holy wars saying, well, now progression seems to work better than regression. Regression seems to work better than plan space. Really, search is for losers, okay? Understand this. You know, I think the important point of AI is if you have a rich uncle, you don't need to do search, okay? And in AI, who is a rich uncle? Heuristic is your rich uncle, which tells you go this direction. It doesn't matter how big your branching factor is, how far the search resolution is. If you have guidance as to which branch to take, you can go home very fast. Okay, so the old comparisons between planners were all about who has the bigger branching factor, who has the smaller branching factor, with the assumption that nobody has any rich uncle. And so these are all, you know, blind search algorithms in essence, are algorithms which have very bad heuristics. Okay, so in essence, in the simplest regression and progression cases, you have these big sorts of trees and you need to decide which branch do you need to go on. Okay, and these the trees are of course very large for even small size problems, and you can get easily stuck in the combinatorics of the search. Okay, so really the question is what branch to take. And one question to ask is, how important is this? Really, is this stopping anything from happening in terms of the efficiency of planning? So before, this is sort of a search tree that was taken between, this is a graph that was taken comparing three state-of-the-art planners at one point of time, I think pre-1995. And they were essentially comparing, you know, I guess, presumably this is the planner that this paper is from. This is working well. I'm assuming nobody would write a graph which their planner is doing worse than other people's one. And so this is sort of better than this, but they're all really losers. I mean, they're going, you know, if you look at the size, the number of objects here is like 5. And by the time it comes to 5 goals, 6 goals, you are increasing the number of CPU seconds very significantly. Okay? So, now, here is a more recent sort of a planning, from the planning competition, here is the most recent snapshot of how different current day planners are able to solve problems. For example, this is, that was actually a rocket problem, and essentially you have two rockets, you have K rockets on the, on Earth, and they need to go to Moon with a bunch of packages. That was that simple, that's the domain that they were looking at there. This one is a PDDL description of a reasonably realistic looking version of operations of Munich Airport. I believe this is from 2004 planning competition. Okay, and you notice that the number of tasks here are 50. Actually, the tasks are not even the number of actions. So, in fact, the number of actions are within, you know, about hundreds of actions we are talking about. So, a branch of depth 100. And remember, search, the blind searches do B power D. So, B is, for most of these domains, B is way bigger than 5, 6, irrespective of which directions you go. And if you are particularly, if you're going in the power direction and don't do proper pruning, the blind searches dies. It can be, you know, 100 could be the value of B. Okay, and yet you're able to solve these extremely well. The number of seconds, this is 10th second here. Okay, and many of these things are being done within a fraction of a second. Okay, so the most interesting thing, I guess, in planning community in the past several years is really the fact that we can solve these problems much faster. Okay, now that I can solve this classical planning problem much faster, now I can then start throwing in all those assumptions that I, artificial assumptions I put. I can now deal with stochastic problems, I can start dealing with temporal planning problems, I can start dealing with partially observable problems and so on and so forth. So the question of course is exactly how did this happen, and I think the main reason, which at least that's what I'll try to brainwash you into believing, is that we now have a very good understanding of how to control search using domain-independent heuristics. In particular, all these heuristics come from a general idea called approximate reachability analysis. And furthermore, they are all basically using a specific data structure, a pretty reasonably malleable data structure called planning graph, which they use in multiple different ways. That's the reason why I told you earlier on that this can be thought of as the lecture about 1001 ways of using planning graph for heuristics for different kinds of planning problems. So let me show you how what we mean by this idea of approximate reachability analysis first. So remember that I have a scenario where I'm trying to figure out, you know, let's say if I'm doing some progression search, I have some states in the fringe of my search tree, and I'm trying to decide which of these states do I expand further, okay? And one good way of deciding this is if you just go from your old A star search things, whoever has the best F value, where F value is G plus H, H is the distance, G of course you know, is the distance you traveled, and you figure that you know exactly how much you have traveled, and H of course is the killer, how far is S from the goal state, Okay, if you have perfect information on that, there is no search. If you have very loose information on that, it's blind search, right? So one question, of course, is how do you compute these numbers? Let's start with a very dumb way of doing it, which is start from F, generate an entire projection tree until one of the fringe nodes has a goal G appearing in it. Then you compute the plan length. That would be the perfect heuristic. And if you supply that, the planner would right away go to the goal. Okay. Now we all know from, so basically that's the perfect heuristic. The question, of course, is you solve the problem in computing a heuristic rather than solving the problem. Okay. How do you do it without wasting all your time in the heuristic computation? So basically you need to do an approximate version of this. You want to do this very quickly. Okay. Before I show this, let me say that there are other ideas of computing this that you might think of. One is, let's say, compute the set difference between G and S. The G is a set of literals. S is a set of literals. Compute the set difference. That's the stuff that G has that S still doesn't have. And take the cardinality of that. That might give you a heuristic. It's extremely easy to compute, pretty useless. You know, in fact, people have used that sort of heuristic, and you know, the planners basically don't perform too well. Okay. Here is a version which is slightly more involved. Consider a structure like this. What I'm doing here is think of some gravity acting on this search tree such that all the states, the membranes disappear. Okay. So here P becomes P here. PQ, PR, PS becomes PQRS. Okay. PQR, PQ, PQS, PSQ, PS, PST becomes PQRS. Okay. Think of these as, these are not obviously states, these are really proposition lists. Okay. The interesting thing is the following. If, let's say, I want to ask myself a question, is it true that, is it possible to reach a state R and M within one step? R and M within one step. All I need to do is go here, this is first zero step, this is first step. Is there R and M here? No. If it's not there, then you can be sure that you can't reach it. If it is there, it may still be the case that you can't reach it. So for example, let's see, R and F. Is the state RS reachable from, looking at this graph, is the state RS reachable? Yeah, because RS is present. Is there an actual state here where RS is present? No. So this is the way the reachability analysis here is approximate. When I say you can't reach it, you definitely can't reach it. If I say you can reach it, maybe you can, maybe you can't. Okay? Now, why is this cheaper to compute? The way I describe this structure, it doesn't look like it is cheaper to compute at all, because the dumb way would be to generate this, puddle this down to this. That's no good, because that way you would have actually done the entire structure there. However, I could say, actually, forget about this. Just forget about this right now. I don't have animation which makes it disappear, so don't look at it. Just look at it here. Start it from P, write all the actions that are applicable, write all their effects, don't make them into different states at all. And then write all the other actions which are applicable in the next level, write all their effects, and just keep going. Okay? Now, so basically all you're doing is you're not differentiating the state. There is no separate state for each action. So what's the difference in computing this structure versus this? This is an exponential time, and this is linear time. Okay? So this analysis basically gets you in linear time. Now, remember that the part where it says something is not possible, it can be sure that if it says a particular state is not possible in level 2, then it's not possible in level 2. So one way you can compute how far the state S is from goal G is start from S, generate this planning graph, see the first level where G is present. G could actually be multiple literals. See the first level where those literals are present. And let's say that is K. Then I can say K is the lower bound on the cost. K is the lower bound on the cost. Now this lower bound can be very bad lower bound. So for example, it's possible that if I ask in this kind of analysis, I could ask what is P and what's the level at which I can get P and not P to be true, and it will say 19. And you know P and not P can never be true together. So the actual plan to generate P and not P is infinitely long. So it's a real lower bound which can be arbitrarily far away from the perfect value. So one question you could ask is, now that I know how to do approximate reachability here, how can I improve the bound? You know, this is lower, this is a perfect heuristic, this is a lower bound. How do I make it come closer and closer and closer? One way you could do this is, in essence, start saying, try to, this analysis, you know, forget about this red part. The rest of this graph essentially is telling you the feasibility of individual single literals being possible at a particular level. Now, it's possible for a literal, two literals to be possible, two goals to be possible individually, but they cannot be done together. Okay? So there are ways in which, in the same structure, you can start doing reasoning about whether or not pairs of literals are possible, triples of literals are possible, four literals are possible, etc. And if you do pairs of literals in particular, that would be called a mutual exclusion analysis. That's part of, from the CSP kind of terminology, that's part of like a C consistency enforcement. And it's basically, if you do this kind of a mutual exclusion analysis, which I won't go into details about, it makes the structure be n square costly to compute, as against O n costly to compute. Okay. Now the advantage about this is, it's up to you to decide whether you want a better heuristic or a worse, you know, you want to spend more time during the heuristic or less time during the heuristic. Okay. So there are, this idea of approximate reachability analysis winds up being, so this idea about approximate analysis reachability heuristic winds up being the cornerstone of pretty much every scalable, most of the scalable planners currently, which are domain independent, which work. Okay. So this is the theme, the variations on the theme completely explain why planners do so much better now than before. Okay. Now, of course, it's nice to know the theme. It's also good to know the variations. So I'm going to spend my rest of my presentation giving you at least some ideas about the malleability of this analysis. You know, how much more, what kinds of variations can you do on this? And then hopefully convince you that approximate reachability analysis, especially with a structure like planning graph, is a useful idea to have in the toolbox. Okay? So here is just a little laundry list of planners for which these kinds of reachability heuristics have been shown to be very powerful. And of course, this is mostly just my group's papers. There's a paper that I have on my webpage which gives sort of a more of a survey feel, which gives all the other planners in the competition that have which also used the same sort of analysis. Okay. So for example, in classical planning, you could use it in classical planning. You can use it in classical planning for forward search, you can use it for backward search, you can also use it for this plan space search, the same sort of reachability analysis. We'll talk after this in a minute about oversubscription planning, where you no longer have goals which must be the true or false, but you have given a bunch of goals and each goal has some utility, each action has some cost, and you're trying to find a plan which is sort of the highest utility, which is total utility minus total cost, highest net benefit. Okay, you could use it there. You can use it in temporal planning, you can use it in non-deterministic conform and conditional planning, you can use it in stochastic conform and planning. Using it, anybody can do. More importantly, the use has shown that if you use this, the performance improves quite significantly. Okay. All of this analysis, again, one question you want to ask yourself, and I hope you understand this, is this analysis does not ask you any more information about the domain than the actions about the domain. All you're using is actions, which is the domain physics. If a planner only uses the domain physics, which is the preconditions and effects of actions, then it's called a domain independent planner. There is another strand of work in planning. In fact, they have planners in the planning competition too, where apart from the domain physics, you also give the planner some extra rules about how to do the search. You know, they can of course be faster, you know, if you actually tell the search how to go, but that would be human coded, hand coded rules. This is all domain independent. So these ideas will work. You know, as soon as you give a PDDL description, these sort of heuristics are being computed. Okay, let's look at, I already said that you can do it for classical planning. Let me give you at least a simple example to make sure that you kind of get it in your head, partly because I have a cool animation that my student made. I want to show it to you. This is actually a simple animation, the other one is nicer. But anyway, so here, if I'm starting from P, Q, R, and M, and I'm trying to The way I would do is I basically generate, if these are the actions, I'll consider all the actions, I'll put all their effects in the next level, I consider again the actions that are applicable in the next level, and then put all their effects. Notice that these dotted lines, all they are saying is if M was true and you don't do anything, M would again be true later. So this structure essentially has certain obvious interesting properties. Once somebody is in, they're in. It's like tenure system. No? So if M is tenured, then M will be there forever and ever. So the only reasonable question to ask is, what's the first level you got in? You know, for professors, you just ask, when did you get tenured? And so that's the redundancy in the structure, in fact. And in fact, there are variations of describing the structure. I'll always show planning graph this way. But if you want to implement this kind of a structure, the best way to implement is as a bipartite structure. Okay, it's a bipartite graph. One level just has the actions, one level has just the propositions. For each action, the only reasonable question to ask is, when is the first level the action came into the graph structure? For each proposition, the only reasonable question to ask is, when is the first level that proposition came into the structure? Now, although I'm not going to talk more about it, if you were to do the mutual exclusion analysis that I showed you earlier, for each mutual exclusion, the only question to ask is, when was the first level the mutual exclusion went away? Because we were sworn enemies, and then we started being friends. Okay, so the way things are mutually exclusive at level K is because there's no way of making this true while making this true in a level K plan. It's possible that there's a level K plus one plan where both can be done. So in the blocks world, for example, suppose I have A, B, and C on the, A, B, and C. A has something on top, B has something on top, C has something on top. Now, it's not possible to make both A and B clear in two steps. But you can make A and B clear in four steps, because you can make one of them clear first and then make the other clear. Do you understand? So things which are not possible to do in a smaller step plans can be doable higher step plans. So the only thing that you would remember in the mutual exclusion is, what's the first level at which mutual exclusion goes away? So again, that's a data structure efficiency issue. You would just remember planning graphs as these bipartite graphs. But for looking at on the slide, it looks nicer this way. So I generated this graph. Now, one way of, in fact, there are many ways you can use this structure to decide how to compute the heuristic. So this is not the theme of the talk, I hope. So I have a goal G, right? I have a goal G. One simple way is to say, look, the cost of getting to goal G is, this is level 1, this is level 2, the cost of getting to goal G is 2. It requires 2 levels. Okay? But the way we analyze this problem, one of the interesting things that happens is we are allowing actions to be appearing together in parallel, even if in fact they are sworn enemies. It's possible that A1 and A2 can't be done together, because A1 requires P, A2 deletes P. But I'm not taking those negative interactions into account. That's why, in fact, I'm able to do this in linear time. Okay? So I might wind up getting the cost of G to be 2 if I just look at the level. But here is another idea I have, which is, actually, show me the plan in this case. So show me the plan which supports G. Show me the plan which supports G. And it so happened, actually, let me see. Yeah, no. Okay, so in this case, actually, this is the plan structure that supports G. Okay, in this case, it turned out that the length of that plan is also just 2. In some other cases, the length of that plan can be larger than 2. Why? For example, some action that comes in here might have multiple preconditions, and you would wind up picking more than one action from this level to support all the preconditions. Now, this is actually a plan. It's a plan for a relaxed version of our original problem. If actions never interacted negatively with each other, this plan would have solved the problem. Now, if you go back to Intro to AI 101, you know that the heuristics come from relaxed problems. Okay, you know, to get a heuristic, you relax the problem, you solve it. And the solution there is the solution, the heuristic for the current problem. So this is a relaxed plan, and this is another way of using this planning graph to get the heuristic. Okay, it turns out that one of the planners that, pretty well-known planners, that uses called a fast forward FF, which actually won the 2002 planning competition, does exactly this analysis. I don't know whether they showed it here or not, but so what happened in this case is you have three states here. For each of the states, you compute the planning graph, you extract the relaxed plan, you compare whichever has the shortest relaxed plan, and you took that state node and expand it forward. Notice you're spending a lot more time deciding what step to do in search than you would be if you were using, let's say, you know, the equivalent of a set difference heuristic for 15 puzzle or 8 puzzle problem is number of misplaced tiles. Number of misplaced tiles is so much cheaper to compute, but we know that those are not the best heuristics, okay? So you might wind up actually spending a lot more time using the heuristic time, but the only thing that matters is the total time, the heuristic plus the search time, and this idea wins significantly. And it's a non-trivial thing. So in fact, when the way this planning graph structure came about is back in 1995, a guy called Avrim Blum, I mean, several of you know it, but Blum and Pearce wrote a plan, a planner called Graph Plan. What it did essentially was it not only generated this planning graph, it also directly searched for the valid subgraph of this planning graph. Okay. Now, to do the valid subgraph of the planning graph, all you need to do is one little more thing. All that you need to do is make sure that whenever there are two actions which are statically interacting, that means one guy is deleting the precondition of the other guy, put a note saying these guys can't live together and never select them as part of the same plan. And so as you start from here and making this plan, if you ever have your candidate plan ever has things which can't live together, you kill that plan and go back and backtrack. If you do backtrack and if you never find a solution at this level, you extend this graph one more level and again search for the solution. The way I'm doing it here is you don't need to backtrack at all because you're ignoring all the negative interactions. So relaxed plan extraction is still linear time. So Graph Plan actually used planning graph, which was a big player in a bigger algorithm called Graph Plan. So in the Graph Plan original paper, first three pages is to plan, describe the planning graph. Next several pages is to rediscover CSP in the context of graph search. Now, current planners completely ignore the search on the graph. All they do is use this planning graph structure to do approximate reachability. To some extent, that was one of the nicest insights that came in the community, and that actually, you'd still do heuristic search, and you're able to improve performance. So now this is basically showing that if you actually looked at planning chapter in Russell and Arvig, Graph Plan is described this way, the way I told you, not the way the paper was written, because by the time he wrote his second edition, he already figured this out. And in fact, he wound up using this version of describing planning graph as approximate reachability analysis. Okay, so having done that, we decided we should try to use it for all other types of planning problems. I'll at least quickly show you how to use it for two other problems, just to give you how you can extend this structure. One is oversubscription. There are many more, but I'll only show you two, don't worry. One is oversubscription. Here, the planning problem is more complex now. You have the same sort of actions, etc., but actions now have, let's say, costs, non-uniform costs. Goals have non-uniform utilities, okay? And your interest is to get a plan that has the best net benefit, optimal net benefit, which is the total cost minus total total utility minus total cost. Now, one of the issues that that sort of was in the background in the previous discussion also is you can start talking about optimal plans versus plan. Okay, whether or not the heuristic search algorithms that I described earlier would give you optimal plans depends upon whether the heuristic is admissible. One of the tricky things is you can do approximate reachability analysis with admissible heuristics, but they don't scale as well as if you don't mind sacrificing admissibility. And in the competition, most planners do extremely well, wind up using essentially, for example, the relaxed plan heuristic that I showed you, which just quickly finds a single plan, that is inadmissible. That turns out to be inadmissible because finding a plan without negative interactions is easy, but finding the shortest plan without negative interactions will require still finding all the plans in the graph. That's exponential. Okay, so if you use relaxed plan, you no longer are admissible, and yet the best planners currently use relaxed plan heuristic. And you know, the way the competition works is the people who are probably optimal wind up stopping at size 2 because they die out of not having any time, and these other guys will probably have reasonably high quality here itself, but then after that these are the only planners which actually solve any problem. Okay, so that's another thing to keep in mind. So again, optimality here would to find the highest net benefit, but using the same sort of philosophy, I'm interested also in finding the best net benefit plan that I can find using my heuristic search. Okay, now how do I do reachability analysis for this? Now if I just have my planning graph sort of idea, the question then is, how do I do these kinds of reachability analysis now that the problem has changed under me? Let me show you one obvious approach. I always think you should understand the dumb approach before you have a chance of appreciating the better one. And the dumb approach is the following. If you have, let's say, n goals, and they're all, remember that something that's obvious, something that's probably kind of unsaid in the previous slide, is I have goals which have utilities, actions which have costs, and the highest net benefit plan may wind up deciding not to even work on certain goals. Do you understand that? So it's no longer the case that all goals must be satisfied. You pick the goals that you can. I mean, that's how we live, right? I mean, you know, it's like you have to send this paper as well as have a good time, and you know, different people deal with that or subsistence problem in different ways. And so you may decide not to satisfy some of the goals, and the best utility might wind up coming when you skip some of the goals. Okay. So the question then is, this problem, I would say, is the same as normal classical planning problem if you know which are the goals that you are definitely going to satisfy. If you have n goals, all you need to figure out is which of the subsets of the goals are really the goals you're going to work on. Now, if you're doing search anyway, do an extra level of search. Okay, this is a dumb idea, remember, which is consider all the 2 power n subsets of the n goals. For each of them, find the optimal plan, find the net benefit for that, and whichever winds up having the best net benefit is the best plan. This analysis basically makes you realize that all you need to do to convert this into a normal classical planning problem, one way of doing this would be to just use the heuristics to pick the subset of goals that you want to concentrate on. So how do I pick the subset of goals which I want to concentrate on without doing the full planning, and so with only doing approximate reachability analysis? And it turns out all I wind up having to do are two small changes to this planning graph structure. One, of course, is previous planning graph structure is just level by level by level. There are no numbers. Actions are all same cost, unit cost. Now actions have costs. So in fact, you propagate costs over these structure, which is not particularly hard. So for example, if I have an action A1 which is supporting P, and A1 has cost 5, A7 also supports P, A7 has cost 3, what is the cost of P? If one guy gives it 5 units and one guy gives him 3 units, unless you have some masochism, you will take 3 unit cost. So the real cost of this is the minimum of the supporters that it has. What's more interesting, of course, is if action A has 3 preconditions, one has cost 1, one has cost 3, one has cost 7, what is the total cost of making all of them true? You can either take max of them or sum of them or some function of them. Normally the ones that are tried are sum heuristic, which is basically add up the cost of the lecture. Remember that when you do that, you no longer are admissible, but we gave up on admissibility back when we were doing classical planning already. Okay, so that's one part. This is this cost propagation idea on top of the planning graph. The second part is which of the set of sub goals to pick. Here is a greedy idea, which is pick first, you know, of the n sub goals, right? You know, when you do the cost propagation, each of the goals have, you know, at the level, at the final level, each of the goals have an estimate of cost that is needed to get to that goal. And they already also have the utility. So each goal already has a net benefit. First pick the first goal to be the one with the highest net benefit. Commit to it in your mind. Find a relaxed plan for it. Okay? Now that you found the relaxed plan for the first goal, the actions that you are already doing to do the first goal are free now. So when you are computing the cost of the other goals, now ask them what is your residual cost, given that I have A1 and A7 already being done. Okay? To do that, in essence, what you do is the relaxed plan extraction procedure would be changed such that you would bias the procedure such that it would try to reuse the actions that have already been committed to. It's just a procedural trick. And then you would then get for each of the rest of the goals what is a residual cost. And so you know the residual net benefit, and you tick the one which has the highest residual net benefit. This is a greedy algorithm. Okay? Turns out that it does much better than, you know, basically picking one goal at a time. Okay? And there are some curves here. I won't show it to you. I mean, all I can say is somebody published this. And one of the interesting things is it turns out you can increase the, you can become less greedy. You can increase the, you know, once you start taking, one of the nice things about spending your time with the heuristics rather than at the base level of the search is nobody is going to look at you the second time if you give them a plan that doesn't work. Okay, so you don't get to give plans which are buggy, but you can give heuristics that are buggy because that's only going to change the search, make it take more time, but the planner, underlying planner will still never let you give out an unsound plan. Okay, so one of the advantages of spending your life thinking about heuristics is you can make them more and more powerful, less and less powerful, whichever works, and then you can try which is the best trade-off. So there are variations of the oversubscription heuristic that I told you earlier that actually take more information about the negative interactions between the goals into account so that you can get a better relaxed plan which captures the right setup of goals. And there's another paper after AAAI 2005, and I think ICAPS last year, which shows that that sort of analysis does pay well. I didn't show that to you. Now, this one is the Ichikawa paper last year, which basically says the same sort of analysis can be used to support oversubscription planning in the context of metric temporal goals. That means you now have actions with time, goals with deadlines, and goals are numeric. Now the nice thing is once you have numeric goals, partial satisfaction is not I take the goal or not take the goal, but it's also degree of satisfaction. Remember, I started by saying I would like to have $10 million, but 1,000 is better than $2. Okay? And similarly, I would like to be done by, I guess, 12:30, right? and getting done by 12:32 is better than getting done by 1:45, you know. And so deadline goals also can be relaxed, and, you know, you have different levels of utility. It's interesting that the same notion of planning graph-based reachability analysis has been extended. You know, if you read this paper, one thing that you would be noticing is the planning graphs now start looking more like this because the actions now have durations. Okay, and it makes most sense to think of planning graph in those cases as this two bipartite graph. And so each action, what's the first time it comes in? Now, the time can be 2.379 seconds. And what is the first time the proposition comes in? That can also be a fractional time. Okay? But the basic principles of reachability analysis, the basic principles of picking up subsets of goals remain. Okay? Now I want to show you probably one of the more colorful things, which is doing the same thing for non-deterministic planning. And so basically here is a scenario where you have the initial state is, so the agent does not have good eyes. So it doesn't know what is the initial state it currently is in. So if there are S states, and if you have no clue as to which state you are in, then your initial state is 1 of 2 power S states. So your search will now actually be in the space of sets of states. Okay? So if you have K literals, K state variables, there are 2 power K states, and if you don't have eyes, then if you have eyes, then you will search in a space of 2 power k. If you don't have eyes, you search in a space of 2 power k, which is basically belief search. Okay? And when you do search in the belief space, either you can consider, I have completely no eyes, so I just keep doing action after action after action, and then I hope that I'll get to the goal state. And I won't even know whether I reached the goal state. I just do 5 actions, and I say, done. And you would know whether I reached the goal or not. And I'm just guaranteeing that I would have reached the goal. That's called a conformance plan, where I am so cocky that I know that this sequence of actions will get me there. The other is I have some eyesight, or I do have full eyesight, but my actions are non-deterministic. So I toss the coin, if it comes heads, I see the heads and then I'll do one action. If it comes tails, I see the tails and I do a different action. So that's called a conditional plan. So in these kind of scenarios, either you can have conformant plans or conditional plans, and you're doing the whole search in a much larger space, two power k space. The nice thing I want to show you is, how do you go about doing reachability analysis here in a sort of a pictorial form? Okay. So suppose I have a scenario where I have a belief state which is PM, QM, and RM. So the belief state has three different states. One is blue, one is green, one is red. Okay. How do I go about saying how far is this belief state from the goal belief state, where let's say some G1 and G2 must be satisfied? One way I can do, the simplest way I can do, is compute a planning graph for each of the states. Now what was a good idea previously becomes the dumbest idea here. Okay. So you compute one planning graph for each state. Okay. Compute the relaxed plan for each of these planning graphs. Merge them. So if the same action is being done in multiple relaxed plans, don't count it more than once. Count the number of actions in all these plans together. That would be a measure of how far this belief state is from the goal state. Okay? This would be a good place to start from. It works, actually. There's a paper in ICAPS 2004 saying it actually works. However, it's too costly. If you have, there can be a large number of states here, and for each of them, you're computing this planning graph. Furthermore, if you actually have non-deterministic actions, then each time you do an action, the world splits again. So you have these planning graphs galore that's going on, and kind of, even approximate reachability can take forever. Yes, sir. Yes. So the other thing that you could do is, as I said, you could do multiple planning graphs. The other thing I could do, and this is the one I'll stop with, believe me, is to essentially say, I'll have only single planning graph, but for each part of the planning graph, I have some notation saying which parts of the world is this piece going to be present in. Pictorially, think of the following way. I have P, Q, R, and M. P is in blue because this will only be present in the blue graph. Q would only be present in the green graph. R will be present in the red graph. Okay? And similarly, A1 is present in the blue, A2 is in the green, R is in the A3. And notice that by the time you come to K, K has blue-green because it is present in both blue world and the green world. Okay? And then finally, by the time you come to G, you keep extending this until the goal comes into the graph and it has all the colors. Essentially, it spans the entire world. So this is blue-green-red. As soon as it has all the three colors, then you start supporting G in all the goals. So notice that when I'm doing relaxed plan here, I'm taking G. I wind up taking A4 as well as A5 because A4 supports it in some of the worlds, A5 supports in other of the worlds. You need all, both of them. And then I take A1, A2, A3 to support K and L, and that's my relaxed plan. And it turns out in this example that the heuristic value I compute is 5, which is the same value I computed if I did multiple graphs. Now, of course, the magic here is all of these have colors. These colors are labels. And these labels are really arbitrary Boolean formulas. And you do Boolean formula management using binary decision diagrams. And this humongously improves the performance of this sort of idea. And in fact, there's a JAIR paper that's coming out in a month, which describes how to do this in all gory details for conditional planning. And this I would skip saying, this basically shows that it does work well. Okay, and this, all I'm going to say is the same idea can again be extended if you have stochastic output. So if the actions have probabilistic outcomes, then you can extend the same idea. The way you do it there is you would sample the world state. And for each sample, you compute a deterministic planning graph. And these are particles. Think of them as individual particles in a Monte Carlo simulation. Now, the more those particles are, the more your effective heuristic would be. And the question, of course, would be what would be a good way of compactly representing multiple particles which are planning graphs together. That's exactly what we were doing in the labeled plan graph. You know, that it was taking multiple plan graphs together. There is a paper on this which shows that using this kind of an analysis improves probabilistic confirmed planning significantly beyond the current state of the art. That's going to show up in 2006. So I'm going to end here and say that a couple of obvious things. One is that a big insight in planning community is approximate reachability analysis. I hope I convinced you that. If you read any planner nowadays, you can ask yourself, what's the heuristic? And more than, I mean, I would bet good money that it would be based on approximate reachability analysis, and it would use one of these sorts of variations. And then it's a pretty flexible idea. These are the various types of planning graph data structures that have been tried. These are the various kinds of things that can be propagated on the planning graph. These are the kinds of planning problems for which approximate reachability analysis has been tried. These are the kind of planners for which approximate reachability analysis has been tried. That seems to be a reasonable reason to remember the technique. Okay? So I'll stop here, and if there are any questions, I guess. Thank you. Okay. Which one? The relaxed plan? Yes. The length of relaxed plan, it is inadmissible. Yeah. Because as I said, it's possible that the shortest relaxed plan in terms of the number of actions, to do find that you might have to search. See, all
but the inadmissibility is defined as whether the heuristic is
So, what is inadmissibility? Let's think about this. So what we're doing is here is S. Here is goal G. If the true cost is 7, and if you think the cost is 9, then you're inadmissible. My relaxed plan heuristic could potentially have said the best plan is this requires 15 actions. None of them are negatively interacting. And so a 15 is greater than 7. While the smallest, if you ignore negative interaction and you find the smallest plan that solves the problem ignoring negative interactions, that's admissible. If you ignore negative interactions, but you don't find the shortest plan, then it's not admissible. But if you do find the shortest plan, then you do exponential analysis.
Right.
That's why you don't do relaxed. So relaxed plans just backtrack research. And if you do backtrack research, you are not guaranteed admissible. It turns out that very few times is relaxed plan heuristic misled. But probably it is inadmissible. That's one.
When you compute the graph plan, right, do you have actions with negative effects?
In the graph plan?
Yes.
So the minimum requirement for graph plan to work, the minimum requirement for graph plan to work, minimum requirement, is that in the planning graph, you mark only the pair of actions that are statically interfering. That means one of the actions is deleting the negative effects or preconditions of the other action. If you just mark that and you look for valid subgraph, that means a valid subgraph is one where no pair of actions in the subgraph have been already marked to be not coexisting, then you are guaranteed to find sound plans. The rest of the graph plan paper really is taking this static marking, propagating it forward. So that, see, the idea is, you know, if you don't do that, you would do a lot of search, come all the way to the back of the graph, and find that, oh, the things that I picked back there are dead. Okay? So the mutex propagation is exactly constraint propagation. Okay? And that's the best way to understand it. And it's kind of nice to know that because that tells you, you know, once you make that connection to the CSP, then you know constraint propagation. You can do more of it. You can do less of it. You know, you should separate our constraint propagation from the minimum requirement of how to specify the problem. Okay. Exactly. Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, so I assume that's going to really vary depending on the domain, depending on the problem.
Yes, yes. So in fact, the other thing is, so for a first order of approximation, the planner performance improves significantly just by doing this approximate reachability analysis, which ignores negative interaction. But then on top of that, there are domains, again, when I say it's improved, this is an interesting thing. In what? Benchmarks. Now, benchmarks are created by people who are running competitions. And we're all brainwashed into thinking of certain types of domains. And just as machine learning has its own benchmarks and they had hard time figuring out, you know, that they won't work in some other benchmarks. So we are trying to improve the benchmarks. But one of the things that happens in every planning competition is, for example, there are domains where FF dies.
Yeah.
because negative interactions matter.
Yes.
And so there we wind up doing these negative, the mutex propagation. Now, in fact, one of the things that, since you mentioned this, if you're coming in the, if you go in the forward direction for each state, you have to compute a planning graph in the progression search tree. Okay? If you're doing search in the backward direction, you have one initial state, you compute one planning graph and you keep reusing it for every state. So upfront, which would you think would work better? You would think regression would work better. But the in practice, regression actually doesn't work as well as doing this planning graph many, many times for each thing in the forward direction. There are good answers as to why that is the case. But then you, one of the reasons is you need to do negative interactions in the account. And there's a paper that's coming. So there are ways, there's a slide that I skipped over in this thing where we did this work in AltArt where we talk about how to adjust the heuristic that you get with relaxed plan heuristic by adding a delta to it. The delta is sort of proportional to the amount of negative interactions that are present in the domain. And it performs quite well, you know, with respect to regression planner. And one of the things that is coming up, and in fact there's a planner called Downward in the most recent planning competition, which kills FF in essence by doing extra negative interaction analysis. But you really have to look under the hood to understand that. And there's a paper that's coming out in the next planning conference, which says, you know, why not learn, given a domain, given an approximate heuristic like this, what is the delta that I'm supposed to add? So if you don't know how to do it, you know, directly by domain-specific, domain-independent way, then domain-specific is okay as long as you don't ask people. And, you know, there is a paper which basically tries to learn this delta. And that works too. So to cut the long story short, there are ways of improving these heuristics, but now you are in a much better Telstra kind of a tower, and now you are improving it further from there rather than doing some other way.
Okay.